I'm here because I went out to those villages this week in Kherson, and I took some food boxes. And we were giving them out to people, and some people said, "No, don't give them to us. There's two invalid
Wow.
ladies that live in that house down the road, and they can't get out here to the street to ask for anything, but they're hungry and they need them more than we do. Please take them to them."
Hey friends, welcome to the Victor Marks Podcast with Victor Marks, founder of All Things Possible Ministries. Welcome to the show where we bring you real conversations faced with life's hard truths, stories of redemption, and the latest from the front lines. Whether you're on the road, getting your day started, or finally settling in, we've got an exciting new episode planned for you. So let's dive in to today's show.
Well, hey, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Victor Marks Show. I've got a dear friend, really, really good friend, colleague, brother in the Lord, fellow warrior. And I mean, we've spent time in places together that would qualify that statement, from Iraq to Mosul. I mean, some hot and heavy places around the globe. And I just thought about the Darien Gap, cruising up that river at flood stage with rain and a thunderstorm that could make Noah proud, and then down in Colombia. But I'm talking about Chuck Holton. Many of you know him as he's part, we call him our associate team member. He works with us. But I say this, Chuck, not to blow, you know, smoke up your skirt. You're really a true quiet professional who does things. I mean, we all use social media to try to get the word out for prayer effectiveness, support. But man, you're just day in, day out. People don't know but maybe 5% of who you are and what you do. And as a matter of fact, to prove that point, you're in Ukraine right now. And that's when we talked, I said, hey, I'm like, man, I got to get you on and talk about what's going on. So welcome, brother.
Thank you. It's good to be here. It's good to see you again, my friend.
Yeah. Folks, we're just going to go right to the nitty gritty, actually, because this podcast, this show is for y'all who have questions. And I told folks, leave some questions on my Instagram account. So they did. But before we get to that, you've been in and out of Ukraine since the happening, since the invasion. And we're going to try to thread real people's, the human need, real life people who didn't ask for any war, who didn't ask to be, you know, uprooted, dead, dying, wounded, and then the craziness of Russia invading. But the reality is, like with any government, the Ukrainian government, there is corruption and all of that. So help us thread some of this in a way where people, really what I want is, you and I, through this, we're not going to change the public's perception or help to change the reality of money's being sent that Americans don't want to be sent. But what I hope, you and I are Christians. We've served our enemy together. We've seen people dead and dying. But like I said in another video, when we help people, it doesn't matter their religion, race, economic, it doesn't matter. We're there to serve and help them in the name of Christ. So that's my monologue. You go for it, brother. Start giving us insight.
Okay, so I think that the real question or the real answers that people want are, look, American conservative Christians are the most generous people group on the planet, but they don't like to be lied to. And because of that, And that because there's so much misinformation and information warfare that's happening around this war, because both sides, Ukraine and Russia, both understand that what happens on the battlefield is actually secondary nowadays in modern war to the information battle space. So the kinetic battle space is actually shaped by the information battle space and not the other way around, where it used to be that the newsreels would be published based on ground truth. And here's what's happening this week in the war. And here's how many people died. And here's where the units are and you know, those kinds of things. Now, the information warfare is happening at such a op tempo that the events on the ground actually follow what's going on in the information war. I can explain more about that. But I'm afraid that many Americans, many people who will be watching your broadcast, are actually being influenced more by Russian information operations than they are than they realize. They have no idea that the ideas that are being planted in their minds by mainstream media are actually coming straight from Russia and Russian propaganda outlets. Now, I've been here since 3 weeks before the war started. I've got a history with Ukraine. I've been in Ukraine starting back in 2007. I wrote a book about bio labs in Ukraine in 2007, a long time ago, long before any of this stuff came out. So I would like to think, having been here now for at least 5 months of this 8 month conflict, that I've got a pretty good handle on at least what's happening on the ground and the actual truth of what's happening in Ukraine. And let me just say, first of all, and as folks, Christians.
Yeah. Before you go any further, I just, your qualifications and setting this up, because there are some people, no matter what you say, they're not going to believe you. No matter what they're being fed by other sources that, oh my gosh, it never stops. But for those who are reasonable, honest intellectuals, and are trustworthy, they know we never bring anybody to the table that we don't trust, vet, know, and believe in. And you're not being paid or compensated by Ukraine's or anything. There's no back door on this.
No. Right.
I just want people to know.
Okay.
So as Christians.
As Christians, whenever we think about foreign policy, United States foreign policy or any other country's foreign policy, whenever we think about geopolitics, it's often very complex and thorny and complicated to try to figure out which side is the right side. Sometimes it's more black and white to us because, let's say, you know, ISIS, for example, that was a pretty clear one, pretty right. Black and white. People, you know, beheading folks, that was more of a, you know, we could look at the radical Islam and say, well, that's obviously not good. So it was easier. In this case, however, you don't have a radical Islam element. The Russian propaganda has tried very hard to paint Ukrainians as a Nazi element, but we have to ask, okay, what is meant by that? What is meant by Nazi element? So before we even get into that, though,
right.
Let's just define the process of how we decide which side we should come down on with our support. And again, I'm just going to say with our moral support for now. And then we have to decide what form that takes after we decide which side to support morally. And in this case, I would say it's fairly cut and dry because Ukraine didn't attack anybody. Period, end of story. Ukraine did not invade another country. Ukraine was invaded by another country. And Russia had a lot of put out a lot of propaganda about why that was necessary in their minds. But the bottom line is, if you don't like the way your neighbor is conducting himself in his house, there are steps you can take to complain to the authorities. You can do your best to cajole your neighbor into acting, you know, maybe not mowing his lawn at 4:30 in the morning or, you know, whatever he's doing that you don't like. But you don't get to go burn down his house. You don't get to go kick right. down his door and rape his wife and murder his dog. You don't get to do that. And that's exactly what Russia has done here. Russia is like the jilted ex-boyfriend who the girlfriend doesn't want him anymore. His ex-girlfriend doesn't want him anymore. She wants to move on. She wants to go date other people. And he's saying, no, if you don't have me, you're not going to have anybody. That's the situation that Russia is in with Ukraine. So from a moral standpoint, it's virtually impossible to make a case that Russia is in the right here. Now, Russia tried to talk about, I'll just very quickly go through a couple of their arguments. They tried to talk about Nazis. Listen, there are more literal Nazis in the United States than there are in Ukraine by a long shot. Agreed. And so if it is a justification to invade a country because there are Nazis living there, then Russia should have invaded the United States. Now, there are also more Nazis in Russia than there are in Ukraine. And the number of people, and look, the Nazis are not in control of Ukraine. They're not in control of the government. There are, you know, your random skinheads, probably a half dozen of them, who were part of the battalion. And those people, you know, when you say they're actually, you know, like neo-Nazis, more like white supremacists, right? But remember, everybody in this area is the same race. So it's not a racial issue. It's not a religious issue. They're all the same religion, more or less.
Right.
What does a Nazi do? Well, a Nazi, tries to force other people to live a certain way, act a certain way, believe a certain way, and persecutes people who don't. That sounds more like Russia in Ukraine than it sounds like Ukraine in Ukraine. Okay. So we can throw out the Nazi argument completely right now. Secondly, Russia tried to push this claim that there were a string of bioweapons labs in Ukraine where the United States was funding labs to develop bioweapons to use against Russia. First of all, it is patently ridiculous that nobody can actually make a good case that there is any country on earth that wants to take over Russia. Nobody wants Russia. Russia can have Russia. We don't want Russia. And now this is where it gets a little more complicated. And I had to actually do a lot of actual journalisming to go figure this stuff out. There was a list on the U.S. Embassy website of labs in Ukraine that the United States government was helping to fund. Those labs are not weapons labs. They were labs that were already existing labs that the United States increased their capabilities. There was a Defense Department program. I interviewed people who were involved in that program that explained it to me in great detail. This program was designed to assist labs around the world to improve their capabilities as far as detecting weaponized strains of like anthrax and Ebola and things like that. So for example, anthrax exists on every farm in the soil. Every farm in the world has anthrax. You can find it anywhere. And it's dangerous only if it's ingested. And the difference between the anthrax, that kind of anthrax, and the kind that would kill millions of people is a difference in scale. It would have to be weaponized by being aerosolized, and that would take a state actor. It's a very expensive, difficult, complex process to take normal, naturally occurring anthrax and turn it into weaponized anthrax. Most of the, virtually every lab in the world, every veterinary clinic, every university, they have a lab on there, and they can detect anthrax, but they cannot detect the difference between weaponized anthrax and naturally occurring anthrax. The United States government got the idea that it would be a good idea to help them get to the point where they could determine the difference between those two in order to be like an early warning system around the globe to let us know if there was something like that that was being developed. Now, that actually helped out the United States back, if you remember, the hoof and mouth disease outbreak or foot and mouth disease, wherever that was in the UK, about, what was that, like 10, 15 years ago. We were able to get word of that outbreak before it reached the United States and shut down imports of beef to the U.S. before it infected U.S. cattle. And that saved us from having to destroy virtually every cow in the United States. So
there was a benefit from having that off-site program versus in the U.S. Yeah.
Right. Now, I went and visited a couple of the locations that were on the website from the embassy just to make sure that they weren't actually legit, like, bioweapons labs. First of all, it doesn't make any logical sense that the United States would trust a country like Ukraine or any other country, right, except our own, to have a bioweapons lab. I've been to bioweapons labs in the United States at Fort Meade and at Dugway Proving Grounds, Utah. And let me tell you, those things are very high security installations. They have big fences around them. They have guards. They have weapons. They have signs that say no photography, no, you know, lethal force authorized, stuff like that. You wouldn't want one of those things in a foreign country that you didn't have complete control over. Right. But just in case, I went and visited some of those locations, and I can tell you that one of them was a veterinary clinic, and it was in a residential neighborhood, and it had a little 2 foot tall wrought iron fence that you could step right over with a gate that was open. I walked right into the building and talked to the people in the building, and they said, oh yeah, we've received money from the United States government. That was very nice of them. They helped us upgrade our capabilities here, but not to create weapons, just to detect bioweapons. Okay. So there's a big difference there. That's a defensive versus offensive capability. Now, Russia twisted that into, we were, you know, creating bioweapons in order to attack Russia. That's ridiculous, patently crazy on its face. Okay. So you can go through those.
But that's where the disinformation comes in. That's where the difference. Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So
if folks remember way back when, well, just real quick, if folks remember way back when in World War I and II, leaflets would be dropped, you know, even Vietnam. Leaflets would be dropped with disinformation in order to grab the person's heart and mind and affect their emotions. And that is what's going on. That's why we're trying to clear it up. Now, I need to get to some of the questions, today. Folks. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Just like it's so easy to radicalize folks into terrorism. So one of the questions is, where's all the money going? We see so much money, and really, I mean, you're a veteran. You were, you were a Ranger. So you get this where people are thinking our borders are not secure. People are struggling over here right now. There's an energy issue. We have inflation up. What does it benefit America to be sending so much money over that, I mean, in the long term, what is the benefit? And is all of it justified? And final part, is it really getting to where it's needed?
Good questions, all, and very important to understand. First of all, I think you have to ask yourself, should the United States be spending any money whatsoever outside of its own borders? And if you are the kind of person who says, no, the United States should never spend a dime outside the borders of the United States, well, then we don't have anything else to talk about. You just have your opinion, and, right. But that's not how the world works. That's not how the United States works. We spend money around the world to try to advance United States interests. And this money, it's very confusing, because when they vote to give $40 billion in an aid package for Ukraine, we get this picture in our head of $40 billion going into the coffers of Ukraine that Ukraine can do whatever it wants to with. That's not how this works. Take that initial $40 billion aid package that they sent. The vast majority of that money actually doesn't even get released until future years, going out to 2037. So if the war is still going on in 2037, then there will be more money made available for them. That's actually $21 billion of the $40 billion what is not available to Ukraine this year. So that leaves $19 billion that is. Of that $19 billion, $9 billion is going to the Pentagon. It's actually going back to our own military to help them replace the weapons that they have already given to Ukraine, which was only about $3.3 billion. So it's basically we're paying the Pentagon to buy better toys after they gave their old toys to Ukraine. So that's not going to Ukraine. That $9 billion is not. $4 billion of that money was going to pay for U.S. troops who are currently stationed in Poland. Now, that's an important thing that we need to do to support NATO, but it does not benefit Ukraine in any way. So a lot of that money, to suffice it to say, make a long story short, a lot of that money is not actually going to Ukraine. It's going to loan guarantees to Estonia to try to get them to buy more F-16s so that they can give their old Soviet era weaponry to Ukraine, stuff like that, which is actually beneficial for U.S. companies. Though that money is not all going into the pockets of Ukraine. Now, the most important question, though, is of the 16 or 17 billion that has been given to Ukraine, that what we're looking at is, you realize the United States Pentagon, the U.S. military budget, is about $880 billion a year. So that means we've only given about 5% of our annual military budget actually to Ukraine so far. 5% is a penny. It's a drop in the bucket, and it's probably the best money that the Pentagon has spent in the last 20 years. You realize in Afghanistan alone, we spent $1 billion a week in Afghanistan for 20 years running. $1 billion a week. Okay, we haven't come anywhere near that here in Ukraine. But what we have received for that money in Ukraine is a great laboratory of real combat conditions of U.S. equipment versus Russian equipment. If you had told American generals that for a mere $16 billion, you can find out whether or not American equipment is as good or better than Russian equipment in real combat conditions, that would have been, they would have written that check all day long. That was right. That's a great bargain. And they've received much more than $16 billion in information, in knowledge, in benefit from that investment than they would have. They would have probably spent that $16 billion on transgender studies anyway if we had left it to the Pentagon.
Now, that's a really good point.
Is it getting to the Ukrainians? The simple answer is yes. I've been literally tracking that myself personally on the ground. I just last week, I tracked 53 drones that were purchased by donor money as they traveled across the globe to Ukraine. And this coming week, I will be driving them out with the chief of staff of the president, driving them out personally to the front lines and making sure that they get to the frontline units. I've already done three of those missions. That chief of staff, part of his job is to go and make sure that the aid is going where it's supposed to. And I can tell you that it is getting to where it's supposed to go, and it is helping the guys on the front lines.
Hey, listen, everything you've shared so far is putting people at ease. I can hear them breathing, going, wow, finally a real source. You know, with the disinformation campaign and people sitting around coffee coolers, water coolers and drinking coffee, someone asked, that's what I'm looking at, somebody asked, hey, is there actually bombings? Are people being killed there? Or is this just, you know, misinformation? I know. But you got to see it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so sad. I mean, it's so sad. I just came from Kherson, recently liberated city in the south. I literally just got back yesterday from spending a week down there. And let me tell you something, the people there are hurting so badly. The Russians are still bombing that area. We were being bombed as we were delivering aid. I was out with a unit kind of like the Free Burma Rangers. It's a younger guy here that started something similar. And Victor, you need to know about this guy. His name is Christian Hickey. He's a currently active national, he's in the National Guard currently as a Green Beret. He was a former Marine and then got smarter and joined the Army and went to Special Forces. but this guy,
he doesn't have crayons anymore. Let's just settle that. He doesn't have access to crayons.
He's graduated from eating crayons to eating whiteboard markers now. So he's a little smarter. They taste better. But so he and his team, and I was with his team along with my daughter who's here with me. We're going out into the recently liberated villages and handing out the food that was donated by the World Food Program, by Samaritan's Purse and others. And I can tell you, look, that place is wrecked. The Russians stole everything that wasn't nailed down. They bombed every bridge. They knocked out the power supply, the water supply, the internet, the cell phone network. And those people, look, there are going to be people, elderly people, who could not afford to leave, because a lot of people couldn't get out. They didn't have passports. Right. They've never traveled in their entire life. They don't know how to travel. And so they had to stay and suffer under Russian occupation. And those people, there are going to be elderly people who we're going to go knock on their door to deliver a food box, and they're going to be frozen to death in their bed later on this year. I can promise you that's going to happen. It's really sad.
It's, folks, because we've been in countries and war, and we understand this, it's in America, you almost have to envision it like a hurricane hitting, say, New Orleans, where it's just wrecked. It's completely destroyed. But then somebody in San Diego, California, right? Nothing's going on. So it depends on what you see. And people suffering is one of our chief aims, is to help relieve their suffering. And, of course, at times protect them. Now, we're going to be part of that, Chuck, that effort. But my question is, because people, obviously one of our main lines of effort and initiative in all things possible is counter sex trafficking and all of that. So, I mean, Ukraine had issues with sex trafficking, and just like any other country, right? And they were probably positioned better for the exploitation of some girls and kids because of lack of accountability and infrastructure. But is it going on more? What are, kind of give people a sense of, you know, those people that help support us.
Did a lot of study about this stuff. Did a lot of reporting on this over previous years, and the book that I wrote had touched on it as well. Sex trafficking became a big issue in post-Soviet Ukraine, because imagine one day, I mean, we've had this discussion with so many people here. It's just fascinating to talk to them about it. You went from a regime under the Soviets that controlled every aspect of your life. You couldn't leave your town without getting permission, written permission, to go to the next town to visit your grandmother or anything like that. So it was completely controlled. They told you what you were going to do for your job. They told you what kind of education you were going to get. You didn't have any autonomy, any personal choice in the matter. And they went from that system to that system disappearing just like that overnight, to no system, basically failed state, no government, no nothing overnight, no rules. And so they didn't even know how to handle themselves. They had gone from a situation like taking a four-year-old that mommy and daddy do everything for them, and then taking them out and dropping them off in the woods and just saying, have fun, you know, taking 400 four-year-olds out there and dropping them off. First of all, a bunch of those people are going to die, and they're gonna form like Lord of the Flies, right?
Okay, but why? Put it in context for our listeners and viewers. Why did it all of a sudden change like that? I got a 25-year-old watching somewhere going, what happened?
Yeah, so the Soviet Union controlled everything, and then the Soviet Union disintegrated. It fell apart. And all of the satellite countries like Ukraine and Georgia and Armenia and Kazakhstan and all those countries, they just all of a sudden are on their own. They're just their own countries again for the first time in 70 years. And so they had to learn how to be civilized all over again. And it started out when there's no rules, you know, basically, if you're not cheating, you're not trying hard enough. Right.
So
that's what it started out at.
For context, it'd be like the U.S. collapsing, but every individual state, they're on their own. So now you have
at least they have a government, right?
Right. I mean,
You know, at least there's a state government can pick up the slack. But here it was all centrally controlled. And then all of a sudden it just poof, it was gone. So you're talking more like Somalia, where there's just no government.
Wow.
right? And they had to just start from scratch. So obviously there was a tremendous amount of corruption in the government and out of the government. They have slowly, as especially Ukraine, has been leaning more toward the West and wanting to join with the EU. Well, the EU has standards. And so the EU has said, look, if you want to join us, you got to meet these standards. And Ukraine has said, help us put rules in place to get to that standard, right? So they've been doing that slowly but surely. They've been getting better over time. Now, sex trafficking was a big deal here because a very poor country, a lot of suffering, and a lot of pretty, pretty women. And unfortunately, as we've seen in the Venezuelans and Colombia just recently this year, as we've seen in lots of countries around the world, when you have beautiful women that don't have anything else to sell, sometimes that's what they decide to sell, is they go sell their bodies because they don't have anything else to sell. And there are people ready, there are predators out there who are ready to take advantage of that and pounce on that and collect those girls up and start trafficking them. So Ukraine was a hotbed for that. The first time I came in 2007, there were plane loads of leisure suit Larrys, these guys that just can't find a girlfriend to save their life in the States, that were creating the demand for these girls flying over here. And they would get off the plane, you'd walk out of the airport, and there'd be girls lined up there with signs for all these different organizations that would sell you a girl for whatever you wanted. Now, when the war started here in Ukraine, that basically came to a screeching halt. It's been getting better. It's not as bad now as it was in 2007. But when the war started, all that kind of sex trafficking came to a screeching halt because now we're in an existential struggle for survival. Okay. Ukraine is concerned right now. Every Ukrainian right now, what they're concerned about is, will there be a Ukraine by the end of next year? And so they are focused on that, just like the United States was after 9/11, where we had this brief moment of unity in our country. That's what Ukraine is like right now. And so I would say that long answer to a short question, it is much better now than it was. Now, does that mean it won't go back after this is over? No, it probably will. And the Ukrainians are going to need more help to keep that from happening.
See, I appreciate that insight, and believe it or not, there's a percentage of people that don't want to hear that. They want to hear it's worse, children being kidnapped, I tell you, please listen to the folks who have boots on the ground, who know what's really going on, because there's disinformation in that as well. You have to be careful about organizations that will sensationalize the situation or need in order to get your money and say, got to do this and that. It's like, oh my gosh.
There is plenty of real need out there
in the
world. You don't have to make it up.
Right? We live this.
And you don't. That's one of the things that I've always appreciated about you, Victor, is that you don't sugarcoat it. You don't try to, make it more than it actually is. You just say the truth of what's happening and you try to do something to address it.
Well, thanks. And again, if we just report the facts, I mean, real life is crazier than anything you can make up, for sure, I think.
For sure. For sure.
Well, let's last two things. One, are we going to be pulled into a nuclear type war, which is going to be World War III?
Short answer, I don't think so.
Yeah, and I agree.
I'll just explain why. Look, Russia knows. Vladimir Putin, he might be a despot. He might be a tyrant. He might be evil, but he's not stupid. No. And he knows the second he pushes that button, his reign comes to an end.
It's done.
So that would be the way he would commit suicide, perhaps. But the second that he were to push that button, and also he is not in total control of that button. It takes many people around him to agree to push that, to go that far before it'll actually happen. Now, there's word out of Russia that he's already ordered 3 nuclear tests in the northern part of his country to basically threaten the world, show that, yes, we do actually have functional nuclear weapons. He's ordered 3 of those nuclear tests, and none of them have happened. Now, we're not sure if they've not happened because they didn't they didn't maintain their nuclear weapons. Those are very expensive and difficult to maintain. Mm-hmm. And they've got 2,000 of them. And so it's a good chance that many of them are duds. Or if the people that he told to do it just flatly refused to do it. Mm-hmm. But suffice it to say that the word is he's ordered three and they haven't gone off. If he were to use a nuclear weapon in Ukraine, that would be a tactical nuke, a smaller nuke. That's not going to take out all of Ukraine. It's not going to take out all of one city in Ukraine. A tactical nuke would take out one neighborhood in Ukraine. And he does not have the troops that are prepared to go into that area. So he would be denying his own troops that area as well as denying it to the enemy. There's no logical pathway that gets you to Putin using a tactical nuke. There's even less of a logical pathway that gets you to him using a strategic nuke. So look, I believe strongly enough that he's not going to do it, that I moved my family to Kyiv for the winter. And so I've got my wife and my daughter here with me. And so there you go.
And I hope that calms a lot of fears. Next thing is, there are actually Christians in Ukraine, aren't there?
Well, of course there are. I've been spending a lot of time with them lately. And let me tell you, there's been a real revival in Ukraine since February 24th for obvious reasons. I preached at a church a couple of Sundays ago, a Ukrainian church, and it was packed to the rafters. I mean, it was standing room only in that place. Mm-hmm. I went to a Wednesday evening prayer service in Kherson just this week, and there were a couple hundred people there, and they were on fire. And not only are they going to their churches and worshiping, but they are taking the gospel to the people and going out and being the hands and feet of Jesus and helping their neighbors. They're taking firewood to these elderly people out in the villages who are going to be reliant on that for their heat this winter. They're taking food out there to those people, and they're praying with them, and those people are receiving Christ. We saw it this week in person, on the ground in Kherson. So I guarantee you that, yes, there are plenty of Christians here, and those Christians are active and vibrant, and they are doing God's work.
What a good lesson for the American church, because I've talked to so many Christians that are waiting for the zombie apocalypse, and, you know, nothing wrong with being prepared and all that, but this mentality of, I got everything and I'm just going to shoot anybody that comes. I'm like, what? How long are you going to, how long are you going to do that?
Right.
That's not what we do. You get enough to help your neighbor. If Christians did that, we're good to go. You step up to protect your neighbor. So, some of that's crazy. So how many Ukrainians have migrated out and, you know, haven't come back yet? And are they being taken advantage of in bordering countries?
At first there were something like 6.5 million that left the country, which would have made them on par with Syria for human migration, you know. Right. However, when they realized that Russia was not going to take over the country in 3 days, most of them came back. And here in Kyiv, there are actually more people in Kyiv today than there were before the war, because you have a lot of refugees from the east that have come here. And this is a fairly safe place. You hear about the bombings that take place in Kyiv, you know, the drone attacks. The first day we got back here, on this trip, there was a big drone attack, and one of the drones hit just about a mile from where I'm sitting. And we went over there, and it took out a building and killed one young family, unfortunately. Realize that Kyiv is a city of 3.5 million people, probably closer to four now. And so if you were in a city of that size, let's say, you know, Dallas or something, or Denver, and they said one building in Denver is going to just spontaneously combust and explode today, you probably wouldn't spend all day hiding in your basement. You know, you're going to go, well, what are the chances it's going to be my building? You're going to go on about your business. And the Ukrainians are very resilient that way. So most of the people who left the country have come back. Of those who are still out or stayed out, I've done some reporting in Estonia and Finland and other places like that around Europe and Poland. And those countries are going above and beyond to help these Ukrainians. And you know the difference that I'll point out between Ukrainian refugees and, say, North African refugees is that North African refugees come from a country from a place they never want to go back to, where it's so bad, a failed state. They live on a dollar a day, and they get to Germany, and Germany has a program. They can get $1,600 a month, plus a free apartment, plus free education, plus free healthcare. And they're like, this is like winning the lottery every day of my life. I'm not going back to, you know, Somalia. Ukrainians, on the other hand, cannot wait to get home. They want to go back, and they don't want to take a handout. And so they go to someplace like Estonia. The first thing they want to do is drive an Uber, get a job delivering pizza, whatever they can do to try to make a little money so that they can, you know, raise the money to help their family and get back and rebuild as soon as possible. They love their country. It's one of the great things about being in Ukraine is that it's not a divided, hate-filled country like the United States is.
Chuck, I got it.
Go ahead.
Well, no, go ahead.
I'm just saying they are a very homogenous, patriotic country, and it's actually very refreshing to see that, to see a country where everybody loves the country and wants it to survive and wants it to thrive and is willing to sacrifice to do so. We were at a pet shelter, an animal shelter the other day that's taken in pets from the areas that were formerly occupied that have been abused and bombed and shot and everything. And they're trying to rehabilitate these animals. And we wanted to help. So I went to give the girls some money that worked there. And they went, no, don't give us money. And I said, why? And she said, no, look, it's just taboo in Ukraine right now to take money in cash for, even if you're using it for a good cause. You've got to go through a process through the government so that there's accountability, so that we don't get accused of corruption.
Wow.
They wouldn't, even under the table, you could not put money in their pockets. You had to do it the right way through the government, or else they wouldn't take it. And so they realize that their survival depends on the help that they're getting from the West. And the whole country is behind that. Everybody from musicians to plumbers to bakers are doing what they can to help their country survive. And it makes me wonder if maybe America needs some sort of existential crisis to bring us together.
Right. Right. Because there is such a difference when folks are patriotic and on the same page, even within diversity, right? You know, we talked right before we went on that there was a shooting here in Colorado Springs at a gay club. 5 people were killed, 18 injured. And some of the comments I got on my post regarding that were just, it's all just, you know, the conspiracy, no compassion. And I'm like, man, what in the world? And I remember asking the guy, I was like, have you ever held anybody dead and dying? Have you had to scrub blood off of you with sand, or you see meat fragments and skull?
It'll sort of change your perspective, won't it? And you know, that's the reason I'm still here, Victor. It's not good for my career to be here because Americans don't care about Ukraine. They don't want to know about Ukraine anymore. Right. But I'm here because I went out to those villages this week in Kherson, and I took some food boxes. And we were giving them out to people, and some people said, no, don't give them to us. There's 2 invalid ladies that live in that house down the road, and they can't get out here to the street to ask for anything, but they're hungry, and they need them more than we do. Please take them to them. So I carried them down there, and I knocked on their door, and they were just sobbing when they saw me. Wow. And they were just so happy to see somebody come in there with some aid for them. I thought I wasn't going to get out of that house. They were hugging on me so hard and kissing me. And these two old ladies just hugging and kissing and just chattering away in my ear and wanted to show me their pictures of their kids who are off fighting for their country on the Eastern Front. And you know what? I said, that's the reason I'm still here. Because look, I don't care one whit about the politics of this. I don't care one whit about it. What I care about is people. And there's hurting people here who shouldn't be, who they didn't do anything. Those, right. those old women are not Nazis. Those old women don't know anything about bioweapons labs. Those women didn't. They speak Russian, for Pete's sake. They are the people that Russia said they were saving by coming to Ukraine. And yet they're going to freeze to death and starve to death in their homes unless somebody like us goes out there and brings them the love of Jesus in the form of a food package and a prayer.
I love
it. That's what I'm doing here.
Folks, now you see why we consider him a team member. While we help support the effort, and it's disheartening to know people out of a good heart give to groups or organizations that you and I know it is not going to get to the end result. So we want to invite people who are watching or listening to this to contact us and say, I'm interested in helping you guys in Ukraine with a very specific mission for the gospel and however that looks. And if that's you all, you got to put it on your heart, contact us so we can continue and help support Chuck. And Chuck, we'll talk offline on some practical things. Do you think Lion and Lambs would be a good tool to help encourage kids in there?
I've seen so many kids, and you know, you just want to have something to give them, but we just haven't had much. These right. beautiful little children. I had a little, like a 7-year-old boy walk up to me in Kherson, and he was looking at the patches on the American flag patch on my med kit. And he's like, Russia sucks. It's the only thing you knew to say in English.
I love it.
I just wished I had something better to give him, you know. But those kids have seen far too much.
Yeah.
There's been more than 400 of them that have been murdered by Russian attacks. There have been something like 1 million children who have been forcibly deported into Russia, kidnapped for all intents and purposes, taken to Russia and given to foster parents, even though their parents are still alive here in Ukraine. And so that's going to be a lifetime in unscrambling that mess when this is over. Mm. But suffice it to say, the need is great. And Lions and Lambs would be very helpful here. Especially as winter comes on. Imagine these kids have lived most of the last year in a bunker in their basement, listening to the shelling outside there, out on the east, you know.
And these are real children. So, folks, let me close for time's sake, and because we could go on and on. We'll do this again, brother. How can people get a hold of you directly for direct support or prayer or to track what you're doing?
ChuckHolton.locals.com is probably a good place where I kind of aggregate a lot of my content because I'm a freelancer. So I'm doing reporting for Newsmax and the Christian Broadcasting Network and others. And then I have my own podcast at The Hot Zone. It's called The Hot Zone with Chuck Holton on YouTube. And so you can go there. I think I still have a page on your website, Victor. They can
yes.
go there if they'd like.
Yep.
Just support that way. But look, I'm a journalist. I'm getting paid to be here, and so I don't need money. But the people here definitely need support. And what I am doing with the money people send to me to help the locals is I'm funneling it through this Green Beret and his organization.
Good.
As they go out into the because they're not. Staying in the rear. They're going right. out into the places where Samaritan's Purse cannot go, where the Red Cross cannot go. They're going right into where the fighting is happening and getting people out and taking food and help and support to the people who can't get out or won't leave.
Yeah. And that tends to be our MO of going where people and other organizations right. can't.
Fill in that gap. Won't.
Yeah. So, man, we appreciate you. God's peace and blessing upon you, and we'll stay connected and get an update. So, folks, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, make sure you pray for Chuck and his family, what they're doing there, and whatever God has you doing, do it full throttle so that he's glorified, you feel a purpose in life, and we push back the forces of darkness for the kingdom of light.
Amen.
Now go get it done.
Amen.
God bless y'all.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode. We'd love to stay connected with you and invite you to the conversation beyond this podcast. You can check out more of the work we're doing around the world at victormarks.com, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, all linked in the show notes. Be sure to drop us a comment in the review section if today's show has impacted you in any way, or if there's anything you'd like to hear more of. We're always encouraged to hear from you. Thanks for spending your time with us. Until next time.